Okay, so here we are at the today at the Reclining Buddha in Polonnaruwa, and we've come all this way to pay respect to our teacher, our leader, and you might even say our Lord and Master, the one who guides us and guides our way, and who we look up to and who we dedicate our lives to. And this is quite a significant step that we've taken. It's quite a significant thing that we've done to do this, to take the Buddha as our guide even, or more as our teacher, as our Lord and Master, or the one who we look to for all of our guidance and all of our answers and so on. It's the sort of thing that you hear about in other religious traditions as well. And for many people, it's quite a turnoff to hear this sort of thing promoted. They'll even think that to do something like this is to follow someone out of blind faith, and to rely on someone else for your salvation, to rely on someone else for your future. And people will think rather that one should look to oneself. And indeed, the Buddha was clear that we should look to ourselves for salvation. And so the reason that, or the answer to as to why we take the Buddha as our refuge, as our guide, as our master, as our teacher even, has to be explained in some detail. And the Buddha himself was quite frank and open about this question, and quite specific in his answers to this question, because he did say, attahi atano natto, you should be your own refuge. We should be our own salvation. So we shouldn't look to a Buddha image to save us. The question is then, why then do we make such impressive, magnificent stone carvings of the Buddha? Why do we even bother? Or why do we bother coming all this way to pay respect to them? What is the significance that they have for us? What is the significance that the Buddha has for us if we're to find the answers for ourselves? And there's a story in the Buddha's time of a Brahmin, Janusoni, who had heard many people saying that they took the Buddha as their refuge, and that they had held the Buddha in such high esteem that they didn't even feel confident themselves proclaiming his virtues. And so the Brahmin Janusoni, he came and he told this to the Buddha. He said, well, these people are saying things like you are incomparable and so on, that they have this great respect for you. They see you they see kings bowing down to you, paying respect to you. They see you being respected by lay people, by people of all castes. They see people coming and ordaining in the multitudes under you. So they therefore think that you are, they therefore believe that you are enlightened, and that you are the Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one, one worthy of following, one who knows all and sees all and has full understanding and wisdom. Complete and perfect enlightenment. And the Buddha said, well, this isn't really how you come to know that the Buddha is fully enlightened. This isn't really how you come to know the truth of the Buddha. And this isn't a good enough reason to take the Buddha as your guide and as your teacher, or even to dedicate your life. You know, for certain, not to dedicate your life to someone just because you've heard other people esteem him, or you see other people respecting him and bowing down to him and so on. He gave the example of an elephant. If you're walking in the forest and you see an elephant's footprint, and it's a big elephant, it's a big footprint. He said, well, an ordinary person might think, well, that's a bull elephant. That's a male, the head of the herd elephant. And he said, but a skilled hunter wouldn't think that. A skilled elephant hunter wouldn't jump to that conclusion, because he would think that, well, there are even female elephants who are big and have big feet and so on. And so this might be one of them, this might be any sort of elephant. And if you see the leaves picked off the trees or the branches broken high up, or if you see this or that sign, he said none of these would lead a skilled elephant hunter to think that that this was, or to jump to the conclusion and to be certain that this was a bull elephant. So only when they see the bull elephant and see its tusks and they see its tail and its ears and all the parts of its body, that they would come to understand that this is indeed a bull elephant. And so he said, in the same way, whether people pay respect to him or people bow down to him or people say this or that about him, or he is skilled in teaching or so on, one shouldn't for that reason come to think that this is a perfectly enlightened one. The reason why we take the Buddha as our refuge and why we have such high esteem for him is because of the Dhamma, because of our own practice and our realization of the Dhamma, even basic realization that what the Buddha said is true. Last night when we were meditating in Anuradhapura, during the night a group of people came walking by and they saw there was a monk sitting in meditation. And so one of them came up and kind of interrupted me in my meditation and said, "Hello, where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Canada." And he said, "So what do you think of Buddhism?" I said, "Well, I'm a monk. I mean, it's kind of obvious what I think of Buddhism." And I said, "What do you think of Buddhism?" He said, "Buddhism is the way. It is the best way to freedom." And I said, "Oh, so you practice meditation?" He said, "No, I don't practice." And I said, "Then how do you know that Buddhism is the perfect way to freedom?" And I think he was quite embarrassed, actually, because really the truth is, how could he know that it's the perfect way to freedom when he doesn't ever practice, or has never practiced the Buddha's teaching? This is dangerous. It's dangerous for us to jump to conclusions. And it's not something that protects the Buddha's teaching at all. It's not something that is... You can't protect Buddhism by just having faith. You can't protect anything by having faith in it. If you have faith in the Buddha and you believe till your face turns blue that the Buddha is enlightened, it doesn't help you and it doesn't help the Buddha, it doesn't help Buddhism. It just makes it look like something that we follow out of blind faith. And so the Buddha said, the Buddha gave a long explanation of how it is that someone comes to realize that for themselves and have perfect faith that the Buddha is indeed a fully enlightened being. So he said, "Here an enlightened one arises in the world. Ida tathagata loke upanno." Here a tathagata, one who has gone to nibbana, arises in the world, fully enlightened. And then someone from a good home or someone from a poor home, someone from this class or that class, goes and listens to the Buddha's teaching. And then they hear the Buddha's teaching and they become confident and they become interested in the Buddha's teaching. And the more they listen, the more they realize that this sort of teaching can't be practiced in the household life. But they don't for that reason... they shouldn't for that reason come to the conclusion that this is an enlightened one. But the interest that they have when they hear the teachings that makes them decide that there's no way that they can practice this teaching in the household life. This happens quite often. I've taught many people over Skype, and this is what you find, because a Skype teaching, a Skype course, an internet-based course, is quite unique in that the person is in general not totally committed to the path. They might never even think to come out to Sri Lanka or come to our monastery or go to a meditation center near them. But they have problems in their life and so they're genuinely interested in the meditation. Once they begin to practice, it's quite amazing, even over the internet, to see the change that overcomes them. That they realize how impossible this is. That they're not able to fully dedicate themselves to this practice, and more than that, they realize that the work that needs to be done, the answer to their problems, cannot come while they're here living the worldly life, or it's very difficult. And quite often, in the beginning, when they said, I could never come to Sri Lanka, I could never come to the monastery, in the end, they start making plans for when they're going to buy their ticket because of the change that overcomes them and how they realize how deep and how important are the solutions to their problems, how important it is to solve these problems and how deep the problems are, how difficult they are to really solve, but also how possible it is. This is the hope that they get when they actually see for themselves through the practice. So here someone goes forth, but another way of looking at this is a person undertakes to dedicate themselves to the practice. So whether they do it at home or whether they do it in a monastery or wherever, they undertake to leave the world. To leave the world behind and not worry about their job or their family or their children or their husband, their wife, their possessions, everything. They put it all behind. In favor of learning about themselves and learning about reality and coming to see the truth of life. And so the first thing they do is they undertake morality. And the Buddha uses an example here. He's using the highest example, and that's the example of a monk. And more than just a monk, he talks about actually the full course of practice. And this is in the Chula Hatipadopama Sutta, where he gives a complete discussion of what it means to be a meditator, the perfect way. So we should understand this to be just an example, because there are many aspects of this path, even to the point of ordaining, that are not completely necessary. Even though ordaining is quite useful, and of course many of these practices are quite useful, they're not all of them necessary. But here the perfect example is this person decides to shave off their head, their hair and beard, if they have a beard, and put on a robe and go forth and undertake the Buddha's teaching in earnest. Because they see that, as the Buddha said, it can't be, or as it says in the suttas, it can't be practiced just like a polished shell. It can't be practiced perfectly pure. There will always be spots and stains and torn edges. It will not be a perfectly smooth practice if they stay in the home life, because they'll have to deal with money and they'll have to deal with bargaining for things and so on. Yeah, today we got an interesting bargain here in the tourist areas. Anyway, not important. So this person decides to go forth. And the first thing they do is keep morality. The Buddha said he went through many of the things they stopped doing. They refrained from taking life. They refrained from stealing. They refrained from cheating. They refrained from lying. They refrained from harsh speech, from divisive speech, from useless speech. They refrain from so many minor things that monks are not allowed to do. They refrain from buying and selling. They refrain from eating in the afternoon. They refrain from wearing ornaments and beautifications. They refrain from raw food, storing food, cooking food. They refrain from many, many things. And he goes through this. They refrain from gambling. They refrain from playing games. They refrain from fortune telling and so on, and all of these things that other recluses, other religious people might still engage in. They give this up, and so their mind becomes calm. They take up this practice of morality, and he said the first thing they do is take up these precepts, not to do this, not to do that. The second thing is they become content with their they become content with just their robes and their bowl. And the Buddha gives this exposition of what it means to be perfectly content. And he says that we should be content with just our robes and bowl. This is the purity of the monk's life. It's not just about all these rules. The rules are in place to keep our minds, to focus our minds, to not... It's not to give us many, many, many rules that we have to worry about. It's to tell us that all of that is off-limits, to give us a big picture of all of the many things that are off-limits, so we can understand for ourselves where our limits are, and to keep our minds within the framework of the practice. Because once you give up all of that, once you give up money, once you give up food in the afternoon, once you give up working and buying and selling, once you give up playing games and entertainment and beautification, all that you're left with is the practice. But then even more than that, he goes on to this simple teaching of just having your bowl and robes. What it means is living your life just you and your robes and your bowl, which is the simplicity of the monk's life. A monastic life, the key to the Buddhist monastic discipline is to be content just as you are. So when we come here to Polonnaruwa, we even thought to ourselves, tonight we could stay here if we wanted, because we don't have a home that we have to guard, we don't have children, we don't have a place, we don't have responsibilities of any sort. We're free like a bird. And this is how the Buddha put it. He said, when someone takes the robes in their bowl, this morning I went through Anuradhapura on alms round. I didn't even need money, didn't need someone to bring me food or to give me dana. Just went walking through the village, and the people were so kind to give me some little food that they had in the restaurants or in their stores or in their homes. And just like a bird flying free with your two wings, the Buddha said. So this is one wing and the bowl is the other wing. The robes are there to cover the body. That's enough. It's just a cloth to cover your body. And the bowl is there to give you enough sustenance to continue on the path. This is the second level of morality, even higher than all of the rules. This contentment, this simple life, where you don't worry, you don't concern yourselves about anything. Now, of course, when we have a monastery and we have a meditation center, there are many things that can be involved. When we want to give a talk and teach people over the internet and so on, then we need supplies and equipment. But in the end, for our own lives, for our sustenance, to keep us going and to keep us happy and content, we don't need luxuries, we don't need entertainment. All we need is our robes and our bowl. This is the simplicity and this is the power of the monastic life. And this is something in and of itself that makes people real, makes people gain great faith in the Buddha. Even when they don't do it themselves and they look at the monks, they see the followers of the Buddha. This is the Buddha said that even by looking at a follower of the Buddha and seeing how well behaved they are, whereas other recluses, well, for example, I mean, not to brag or look down on anyone, but an example that is a fair example, I think, is there was some strange sadhu, I guess, I don't know what you'd call him, but he was wearing a similar robe and he had a beard and had long hair, and I met him on the road and he said something to me, and he had a little thing here, I think he was Hindu or something. And while I was going on alms round, he was in the stores buying food. So the example here is the difference. The point is, people, when they see the Buddha's disciples, doesn't mean they're enlightened or that they've realized the truth for themselves, but that they are well disciplined. And for this reason, people will come to say these people are enlightened. I've had people come to me and become incredibly sure that I was on the right path and that I was some pure and perfect monk, and therefore gained great faith in the Buddha's teaching just by seeing me on alms round, or that I only wear these simple robes, and that I go for alms every day, and that I don't touch money and so on. But the Buddha said this isn't a reason to think that either that person or their teacher, for sure their teacher, is a perfectly enlightened Buddha. And this is indeed the case. These people who had great faith, a month later, 2 months later, they might for some silly reason decide that I'm useless, or that this monk is, or they'll get bored or so on, or many things can happen. That their faith is not stable, because it's just blind faith. It's just irrational faith. There's no direct connection between this practice and enlightenment. It's something beautiful, and it's something wonderful, and it's something powerful. And it is something that leads people rightly to decide to undertake this practice. The story of Asaji, who went walking through the village on alms, one of the first five disciples of the Buddha, who was an arahant. And when he walked on alms, anyone could see how pure and perfect he was. And so this is what attracted Upatissa, who later became Sariputta. The reason why Sariputta joined the Buddha's order is because of Asaji. He saw Asaji going on alms round and he said, that is an enlightened being. And he was sure. But of course, Upatissa Sariputta was a very discerning person. But it's a good example for us that even just seeing this purity, that these monks really need only this, their robes and their bowl. So this is something that we strive for. And even lay people can strive for this sort of thing, to live, all of you, you know, you've come here, we all slept last night under the chaitya with Yasa and Sumedha, who couldn't join us here. And this is a great power that we have. Ordinary people can't do this. They would go and they would know, we need a hotel, no? We need to go to, we can't possibly stay out overnight in that way. So we have this power of morality, of being able to, of contentment, of being able to give up our attachments to things. This is a kind of morality. The third level of morality then that the Buddha talked about is guarding the senses. He said, then the noble disciple guards the eye, and whatever they see with the eye, they don't, and the Buddha uses this term, they don't allow their minds to perceive or to go into the characteristics and the marks and the aspects of what is seen. This is a very important teaching. This is very, very much the core of our practice. This is how we begin our practice. Our practice begins with, let seeing just be seeing. Let hearing just be hearing. As I said yesterday, dipte dittamattang bhavisati, sutte suttamattang bhavisati. When we see, let it just be seeing. When we hear, let it just be hearing. And the Buddha said this quite clear in the Chulahatipadopama Sutta. He doesn't pay attention to, he doesn't allow his mind to conceive the characteristics of what is being seen. So if it's something that normally would seem beautiful, still just see. If it's not something that would be ugly, still just see. And eventually, through our practice, the mind comes to this, that what is seeing really is just seeing. All of the aspects of good, bad, me, mine, and so on disappear. With the ear, whatever sounds are heard, whatever. With the nose, whatever smells are heard, it's just smelling. With tastes, whatever tastes we taste are just tasting. When we're eating our food, we become aware, tasting. We know that this is a taste. When we feel something on the body, whether it be hot or cold or hard or soft or some pleasurable feeling or some painful feeling, we know it just as a feeling, whether it's painful or pleasant or so on. And thoughts as well, whatever thoughts we have that are pleasurable or displeasurable or unpleasant, we know them just as thought. And this is where our practice begins. This is the moment that morality turns into concentration. So this is the highest form of morality. It means guarding the senses. So that, and he says, because if we didn't do that, there would arise liking, there would arise disliking, there would arise all sorts of unwholesome states. There would arise addiction. When we see, then we would be happy about it. We would be attracted to it. When we hear, then we would be attracted to the sound or repulsed by the sound. When we hear this noise, then we would be angry or upset by it. When we have smells, a good smell or bad smell, all of us, none of us have showered in a day or more, we have this bad smell and we become repulsed by that. When we have tastes, when we eat our food and it's good or bad, feelings and so on. All of these will give rise to addiction and aversion. This is what creates all of the problems in the world. We think that the problems in the world are caused by conflict, are caused by real problems that arise or so on, but in the end they only arise in the mind. When we take an object as being more than it is, when seeing is no longer just seeing, but it's me, it's mine, it's good, it's bad. This is my friend, this is my enemy, this is my food, this is my body, no? When our body is too fat or too thin or too tall or too short or too white or too dark, then we think, we feel very sad about our body. Or when our body is beautiful, when our body is the right shape or the right color, we become proud of it and we become attached to it. And then we do this with everything. We'll do this with people. This is my husband, this is my wife, this is my son, this is my daughter. And then we become attached to them. This is my father, this is my mother. And then when some change overcomes them, then we suffer. So this is what it means, morality. Morality is to keep your mind from falling into unwholesome state. Once you do that, concentration arises. Concentration is the state of mind that is free from those states. And then we begin the practice. This is how the practice begins. There's morality and contentment, and then we have this guarding and focusing the mind, and then finally just knowing the mind, the movements and the activities of the body and the mind. And so then the Buddha gets into the actual practice. He says, for this reason, even though then their mind becomes focused, they still don't think that this, they still don't know for themselves that the Buddha is enlightened. Because it's possible that in other religions or religions that where there isn't an enlightened being, that this can be taught or this can be achieved. And then that person undertakes sati and sampajanya. Then they undertake the practice. So once they're guarding their faculties, guarding their senses, then they become aware of everything they do. When they're walking, they know they're walking. When they're sitting, they know they're sitting. When they're standing, they know they're standing. When they're lying down, they know they're lying down. When they're eating, they know they're eating. When they're drinking, they know they're drinking. When they're talking, they know they're talking. When they're silent, they know they're silent. When they're urinating and defecating, this is in the suttas. People become shocked by hearing this, but the Buddha actually said, your meditation practice has to go through your whole life. A person who is really meditating should meditate over urinating and defecating as well. At the moment of urinating, they know they're urinating. At the moment of defecating, this is coming to understand reality, because this is a very, very ordinary part of reality. When waking up, they know they're waking up. When falling asleep, they know they're falling asleep. Every aspect of our lives, when walking, 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 when talking, 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 you can even feel your lips moving and know that you're talking. When listening, hearing, hearing. When urinating, urinating, and all the feelings and so on. When showering, when eating, chewing, chewing, swallowing, and so on. This is how our concentration develops. This is really the basis of the meditation. This is how we teach people when they come. What we're doing when we teach you the mindful prostration, walking meditation, sitting meditation, is exactly this. We're giving you simple exercises that will serve as an example for you to then take into your daily life and develop through your whole life, until your whole life becomes mindful, so that you're aware and clearly alert. You have sati, you have mindfulness or awareness or recognition of things, seeing things as they are. And then you have sampajanya, the knowledge of these things as being impermanent, unsatisfying, and unsolvable. Just simply seeing them as they are. You know, the recognition and the awareness. And what does this lead to? This leads the mind to become, this is where our concentration is developed. Now, concentration has the effect of, as the Buddha said, removing the hindrances from the mind. And this is really the most important aspect of the practice, that our practice should help us to overcome the kama chanda, the sensual desire, which I talked about in regards to morality. What it means is, by practicing the morality and guarding the senses, and by practicing in regards to the postures and the movements of the body and the feelings and the thoughts and so on, our sensual desire will be repressed, you know, will be removed. There will be no opportunity for it to arise. Of course, if we stop practicing, it will just come back and will give rise to more projections and judgments of objects. But during the time that we're practicing, it has no opportunity, because seeing is just seeing, hearing is just hearing, walking is just walking. And the same goes for our ill will. We will have no aversion towards things, and our drowsiness will go away. We will not become lazy and depressed and drowsy in the mind. Distraction will go away, and our mind will become focused. We will not have any distraction or worry about the past deeds or worry about the future. And our doubt will go away. We will have no doubts in regards to the practice. Every time we have doubts, we will say to ourselves, doubting, doubting. And we can do this with all of these, actually. Part of our practice is the inclusion of these. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha said, even include these in your practice. So not only are we focusing on the senses, we're focusing on the movements of the body, but this is the third one. The Buddha said, when you have sensual desire, you know, wanting or liking. When you have anger, you know, angry or disliking. When you feel drowsy. When you feel distracted or worried. If you have doubt, say doubting, confused or so on. And these are removed from the mind. This is the development of concentration. So this is where the Buddha said, morality leads to concentration. So this is how our practice goes. Now what does concentration lead to? Well, the Buddha goes on, but I'm going to cut it short because the rest of the path is more or less optional. This is the fruits of concentration, that one can read people's minds, remember past lives, fly through the air, that the mind can become quite focused. The most important aspect is that the mind becomes focused and the hindrances are repressed. The hindrances are removed from the mind temporarily, because it's these hindrances that the Buddha says in the Chulahatipadopanna Sutta. The hindrances are an obstacle to wisdom. And this is the what the Buddha says. What are these things? What is the problem with these things? That they are an obstacle for wisdom. So all of these other fruits of the practice are actually incidental. The ability to read people's minds and remember past lives, it's not really wisdom. It's wisdom in a worldly sense, but it's not. If you go through the sutta, you see that even for this reason, when one remembers one's past lives, when one reads people's minds, even for this reason, one would not say, oh, my teacher is enlightened. How could one? This is not real knowledge. This is just an experience of something in the past or something in the future or something external to yourself, some concept. And so the most important thing is that one continues the practice, whether one gains magical powers, whether one gains deep states of concentration or not. What's most important is that one comes to realize the truth of reality, that one comes to give rise to wisdom. And so the Buddha said the point at which the person is able to realize that this is indeed, and my teacher is indeed enlightened, and this is indeed a fully enlightened being, is when one realizes for oneself the truth that the Buddha called the Four Noble Truths, the real truth of life, which are the truth of suffering. The reason why something unpleasant occurs, the reason why a problem of any sort occurs. These are the only truths that are really useful. If you think about it, you can see that the only really, truly necessary truths for us to realize, no matter what other truths we realize, is the truth of suffering. The truth of suffering in the sense that, what is the cause of suffering? Why is it that we suffer? Because if we had no suffering, nothing else would matter. It wouldn't matter whether we could or couldn't read people's minds. It wouldn't matter whether we could or could not see far away or so on. It wouldn't matter if we had all the intellectual knowledge in the world. Once we understand the truth of suffering, and we understand those things that cause suffering as causing suffering, once we understand those things that are unsatisfying as being unsatisfying, then we will never cling and we will never attach, we will never follow or chase after those things ever again. We become free from suffering. And the Buddha said in this way, he comes to be free from what the Buddha called the asava. That the reason why we understand, the reason why we believe, the reason why we would even take the Buddha as our Lord and Master, it's a very difficult thing for people to hear, I think, is because we come to realize the truth for ourselves. We come to see that indeed, one, it is possible to become perfectly enlightened. Two, our teacher teaches the way to become enlightened, to become free from all defilement. And three, we have for ourselves become free from, have gained some measure of enlightenment. This is when a person takes the Buddha as their Lord and Master. So I'm not trying to say that this is about any of us, but this is how we should reserve our faith in the Buddha. That the faith that we have should be limited to the results that we have gained. Until we realize for ourselves the truth of what the Buddha taught and the truth of life, and that everything that arises ceases, that there is nothing in the world that can bring us happiness, and therefore nothing in the world, in any world, any frame of existence, that is truly satisfying, that should be clung to. Nothing worth clinging to. No dhamma, sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya. That no Dhamma, no thing is worth clinging to. Until we realize that for ourselves and truly realize it and therefore have no clinging inside, whether it be clinging to sensuality, whether it be clinging to becoming, or whether it be clinging just due to ignorance. Those are the kamasava, bhavasava, avijasava. Whether it be any of these types of defilements in the mind, whether it be the defilements in regards to sensuality, all of these are gone. Because all of the objects of the sense, we've come to see them just as arising and ceasing. They can't satisfy us. We've come to see them just for what they are. We've come to see that what they are is something very, very simple. It has nothing to do with good or bad or me or mine, pleasant, unpleasant, desirable, undesirable. They simply are what they are. We've come to see this perfectly clearly. We've come to remove all of the illusions and delusions, all of the habits that we have, all of the partialities that we have that are based on the baseless, that have no basis in reality. Whether it be in favor of things or against things, we have no aversion towards things at all. We see those things that we thought were ugly or unpleasant or undesirable or fearsome or so on, are as well simply experiences that arise and cease. Bhavasava is in regards to becoming. So in regards to becoming this or becoming that, we have no interest. We've come to see that anything that we become, anything that becomes, will have to disappear. It can never last forever. No matter what high state of mind we might have, in the end it has to finish, it has to dissolve. When we stop working for it, when we stop striving for it, it will disappear. And so we give up all striving, we give up all clinging, all desire for any becoming, or for any non-becoming, for getting rid of anything, for removing anything from our lives. We come to accept what is and be perfectly content with what is. Or avijasava, any kind of taints or any kind of delusions that come simply from ignorance, we remove all of these as well. So all of our conceits and all of our arrogance, all of our wrong views, we remove them as well. All of our views, any views that we might have or opinions that we might have, this is right, that is right, this is wrong, that is wrong, I believe this, I believe that, we throw it all out the window. Once we can do this, then we are said to have seen truth, and it's as though then we have seen the bull elephant, in the sense that then we have come to know that the Buddha is the Buddha. We've come to realize that anyone who can teach this teaching that we have practiced and learned is truly indeed a perfectly enlightened being. So this is the point where we come to truly understand and have faith in the Buddha. So all of us are working towards that. We're on the path working towards that. So how we should react, how we should relate to this, is that our faith in the Buddha should be perfectly in regards to our practice. We all have faith in the Buddha, not because other people have said that he's this or that, or because of how we've seen other people act, or because we have faith in other people that we've seen, but because we ourselves have to some extent realized the truth of his teachings. And to the extent that we've realized the truth of his teachings, to that extent we've become faithful, we've become confident in him, and we've taken him as our teacher, our guide, our Lord, and our Master. And of course, the great thing about the Buddha's teaching, which should reassure all of us, and certainly reassures everyone everyone that I talk to or teach Buddhism, is that the more you practice, the more you want to practice. So you might have decided when you first came to practice, just come for a few days to try it out. But even when you come for just a few days, after a few days you want to stay for a week, and after a week you want to stay for a month, and after a month you decide you want to give up your life and become a monk. Anything could happen. Because this is the Buddhist teaching, is opanayiko, it leads you on. It's something that the more you practice, the more you want to practice. The more faith you gain in the practice, or the more you practice, the more faith you gain, the greater confidence you have. So there never has to be, in the Buddhist teaching, never has to be, never should be, and never has to be some sort of blind faith or some sort of clinging to faith, that any kind of fear that you might be wrong or fear that you might somehow lose your faith in the Buddha Often I will instruct people to give up their faith. Say, whatever doubts you may have, just give them up. Give up any faith that you have. Don't try to cling to it or make yourself believe. Give it up. Because the truth will come by itself, and the truth will give you an unshakable faith, an unshakable conviction in the Buddha. Once you realize the truth for yourself, you'll never have to have any sort of attachment to faith or any kind of clinging to faith. The faith that you will have will be based perfectly on your understanding. And so that is what it means, I think, for us to take refuge and to take the Buddha as our guide and master. And it's a perfectly good reason for us to make such statues, because even from what little we've gained, if you think of what little we've gained of the Buddha's teaching, we can see that even that very little amount is incredibly profound. That this little piece of the Buddha's teaching, and we know that we haven't made it maybe anywhere near the goal, but even that we've gained is something that has changed our lives in a very profound way. We used to do evil things, and now we don't do evil things. We used to avoid or even look down upon doing good deeds, and now we undertake good deeds. We used to think of meditation as a waste of time, and now we think of everything else as a waste of good meditation time. And so, to me, it's actually not such a remarkable thing to think that someone would carve a rock like this and make a Buddha statue, even as impressive as it might seem. It's actually, for someone who's practiced meditation, quite a small task. Carving something into a rock is a small task compared to the task that we have ahead of us and the task that we are undertaking. Even a week in meditation seems to be a much more difficult and much more worthwhile task, and a much greater greater respect and homage to the Buddha. And this is how the Buddha put it as well. And it's great to see this kind of homage being paid, but he said this isn't the true way to find homage, to pay homage to the Buddha. If we think of the Buddha when he was about to pass away, and all the people from all of the country and all of the monks and even all of the angels were bringing flowers and candles and incense to pay homage to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, this isn't how you pay respect to a fully enlightened Buddha. But he said, whatever person, be they a monk, a nun, a layman, or a laywoman, if they practice the Buddha's teaching, yo ko ananda bhikkhu wa bhikkhuni wa upasako wa upasika wa dhamma anudhamma patipanno anudhammachari samiji patipanno anudhammachari so tathagatang garu karoti sakkaroti garu karoti. This is a person who acts proper in regards to the Tathagata, the Buddha. Someone who garu karoti, who acts with homage or respectfully towards the Buddha. Manyeti pujeti, who pays homage and pays respect to the Buddha. Someone who practices correctly, who practices the teaching in order to realize the truth of life. So this is what we aim to do with our practice and as Buddhists. And this is where we should find faith and respect for the Buddha. And this is kind of an explanation as to why we have such homage and such admiration for the Buddha, and why we don't spit on the Buddha images, as they say, or we don't look down on the Buddha images. Because this is a picture of our teacher. This is someone who is our guide. It doesn't mean that we take these things as a substitute for practice, but we take these as a sign of honor and respect. And we respect these things, and we respect them in place of our teacher, who has already passed away into perfect peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. So I hope that has been of some use. Thank you all for listening, and wish you all and everyone listening in to be able to practice the Buddha's teaching and to find true peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering for yourselves. Thank you all for tuning in, and wish you all the best.